I am Dwayne Scribner. For last week, this week, and next week, I have the title of literature teacher, literature person on the staff at Holden. I come from a background as a teacher of English and as a person who has worked in offices of elected officials in the U.S. Senate and in a governor's office. So I kind of combine an interest in literature and in politics, and that happens to fit very well with some things that are going on here. I was once a professional teacher with a political avocation, and then I was a professional in politics and government with a literature avocation, and now I work for a corporation where I have the unusual job, at least there aren't very many people who do this kind of work that I know of translating, of trying to help translate the public sector for the private sector and the private sector to the public sector as a person who is concerned with government and community relations and community contribution programs and volunteerism and those sorts of things in a small department in a large corporation. In these 2 weeks, I've been trying to use literature to illustrate some things about living the politics of hope, which is the theme for this summer at Holden Village. Last week, we did that by looking back at the American Civil Rights Movement, at least the last 25 years of it, the Martin Luther King period of it, a period in which a group of people actually took it upon themselves to change the law of the land and the practice of the people of the United States through political action, including action on the streets. And we used a long novel, Five Smooth Stones, to do that. This week, we have been, I'm trying to use three short books, George Orwell's 1984, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, three books that are very much alike in some ways but very different in others, in order to put a perspective on the issues surrounding peace. And as you well know, if you've been attending sessions the last several days in particular, the issue of peace and disarmament and war is a major one in the village this summer, and particularly in these 2 weeks, and I must say, quite appropriately, this week, in the week before we celebrate Christmas at Holden. It's obviously a controversial issue. There are people who have very strong feelings about it, and what I try to do in these sessions is to provide some perspective through literature on that issue and that controversy. Next week we will be back to Martin Luther King and Five Smooth Stones. For those of you who are going to be around, I hope that tomorrow or the next day you'll be able to see, if you want to, the film Heritage of a Dream on Martin Luther King, which is one of the basic pieces, because I think it's also a good piece to use to look at the elements of a successful political movement. And that is what we are talking about this week with regard to disarmament, at least some people's hope for a successful political movement. Today, in this session called Reading for Insight and Perspective, we are going to use short pieces from the materials I mentioned, along with a couple of other things, to really get at the issue of how we can read for perspective. If literature, as I think it does, can provide perspective on politics, how do you get that from it? And the principles are fairly simple, but when we translate it into looking at literature, we usually find some interesting things that are helpful. The reason My reason for doing this, right up front, and just so you, so everyone understands it, is that I really believe that critical thinking, critical reading, and critical listening are the keys by which we open the door to finding our way through on controversial issues. If the world were the way I wanted it to be, none of us would be dependent on having other people frame our thoughts. We would be able to make all those judgments. We'd be able to know enough to make all the judgments that will help us to be independent and free thinkers, and not be at the mercy of who has the slickest way of approaching us. And that, of course, applies to a great many things besides politics, but it's very important there. So what we are going to do today is to take one thing which is very, very familiar to you all, and it's deliberately chosen for that reason, but the hope and the expectation that you will have been over it so many times you may think it's old and trite. And we'll try to take, this is a poem called The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. And we'll take a look at that poem and see what it tells us about, what it might tell us about the politics of hope as it applies to the disarmament issue. Now that's really stretching it. But I think by the time we're through, you may have some insight. It won't take very long to do this, I hope. You will have some insight into the kinds of ways in which a poem, particularly one that is metaphorical and uses the specific to get at bigger issues, can help you to think about something like war and peace and disarmament. We'll go on from there to a couple of short passages one from a novel that, again, is entirely outside the ones I've chosen this week, and then a passage from 1984 and a passage from the Martian Chronicles, taking a look successfully at those things. And then, if we get through with that, we have time, we might even listen to a brief folk song that will help us to focus. So let's just get right into that. I'm going to start with The Road Not Taken. And I thought I could basically just come in here and recite the poem to you because it would be so familiar to you that you probably can recite it to me. But then I thought, well, if we have it on a piece of paper, it'll give us just that much more to hang our hats on. This is a poem that many of you probably paid some attention to in high school English class or a college English class, the required ones somewhere along the way. This is a poem that's used all the way from the upper elementary school on up. So it's really a piece of our folk literature in a sense. It happens to be from one of my favorite poets, and one who is one of the best ones to get into, and we're going to look at it as a metaphor today. I'll explain that in a minute. This poem is entitled "The Road Not Taken," and it's a fairly straightforward poem. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. What does this poem say to you? Call up some of those old thoughts. All right, bang, just like that, you see? There's a poem that's about a road in a wood, a fork in the road, a very common sort of thing. And the first response is, life is a series of choices. Now that, we all know that. What makes that, what's so important about that, about life being a series of choices?
Well, sometimes you're tempted to do just what the people are doing, instead of thinking definitely what you are doing.
All right, sometimes you're tempted to do what most people are doing, other people are doing, instead of what you'd like to do. So that sometimes those choices that you make are choices between going along with a crowd. This is one of the most common ways in which this poem is discussed, going around along with a crowd or being a nonconformist. You notice how much of a nonconformist here? Yeah, the least traveled, but notice what it, but not very different, not very different. As for that, you know, wasn't as much traveled, but as for that, passing there had warned them really about the same. And that morning, nobody'd been on either one. Think of yourself out on the trail at Holden, trying to find a way to go. Okay.
It's not really passing a value judgment. It's not saying this is better than that.
All right, that's really significant insight into the poem. He says it has made all the difference in the end, which means that somehow that choice was important. But it doesn't say, does it, that taking the one less traveled by is better than taking the one more traveled by. It makes him as equal a choice as he can, though he suggests that the I in this poem, I should say, be careful not to equate this with the author, it's not necessarily the same person, says, I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. What else sticks out here for anybody? Yes? All right. One of the most significant things it seems to say in terms of the choice of life is that, in fact, we do have them. We do make them all the time. All right? Yes?
There's also the element of not ever probably taking the other. Choosing one, you choose not to do the other.
I doubted that I should ever come back. When you go down the road the one way, person of the poem suggests you probably never get the chance to go the other way.
And even if you do, it's going to be different because it's a different
time. All right. Exactly. Even if you should happen to come back to the same corner sometime, it won't be the same experience.
I think there's less in the poem about making a decision than there is about living with a decision.
Okay. Yes, that's right. That's a good comment. I hope everybody heard it. That we don't know what's down that road. It's living with the consequences more than making the choice. As a matter of fact, there's something really different about this poem, which it's worthwhile thinking about. This poem is not called Less Traveled By. This poem is not called I Took the Road Less Traveled By, or Taking the Less Traveled Road, or something like that. It's called The Road Not Taken. And we've been sitting here talking about taking the road and having the difference, where there's a difference. And really the title of the poem is about the one, seems to be, has something to do with the one not taken. Yes? What do you mean by that? There's a leap of faith. Yes. And that relates directly to what was said over here. It's the, you have to live with the consequences. And you take those consequences without knowing exactly where they lead. Does that remind you about anything in the Christian ethic? Anybody prepared to make a Bible study out of this?
Yeah, the road less traveled is not a popular. That's Christianity.
All right, there's an element of that. That certainly is one of the things it suggests from the context, even though it says the road less traveled by, and it says it isn't a value judgment, and so on. Nevertheless, in our minds, and I'm certain, the creator of the poem, as well as we, is sensitive to the fact that not going with the pack, even though it's a small choice between the two, is often, at least, not the popular way. I'd say, I'll go a little further with that, though. A little bit further with that. The leap, think of this in terms of the leap of faith, or a leap of faith. Yes?
But you have to trust in God to lead you down the right path.
All right, putting it just in those terms, the trust in God that he'll lead you down the right path, calls up a whole collection of things out of our tradition. And not only, it is out of, in that case, the religious tradition, but not only that, it's out of our whole history. How many times in our understanding of life, historically, have we gone down paths without knowing surely where they were coming out? Think of some examples in history. Without being sure, just launching out without knowing for sure where you're going. Good example. I'd start even before that. All right, the voyages of discovery. The voyages of discovery that were taken, and then just carry that on. The settling of the frontier. People stepping out into the wilderness without knowing what was out there, in some cases never being heard of again. The whole immigration thing. Think of, for most of us, all of us, I guess, at some level or another, our ancestors doing that. Sometimes with an idea of what was at the other hand, but never for sure knowing. Now let's move that back down into a more daily experience. It's also true, at least to some extent, that we don't know where we're going one day to the next. Uncertainty is something that we live with. Uncertainty of the consequences of our actions, the possibility of hurting ourselves or other people or so on. Now, I'm starting to carry the poem pretty far, and I said we were going to do that just for purposes of exercising our sensitivities in the political area. Now, what in the world could all of this have to do, first of all, with living the politics of hope, as you understand it, in the environment we've been in the summer?
Giving someone the opportunity or the chance of doing what they feel is right, and we have chosen them as leaders, and if they have the faith in God as we do, they're aiming to do the right thing, too.
Alright, there's a certain element here that says just as we take our own plunges ahead in the hope that the fact that we are trying to do the right thing, in whatever terms that is, will lead to, even though we don't know the implications for sure of that, suggests to us that there's a certain reason to trust others to do the same thing. You mentioned leaders, and that's very important. I would say whether they're leaders or not, but to sort of suggest that we are all in this environment where we don't necessarily know how things are going to come out, and sometimes don't even know for sure we're right.
I think you said the political statement.
That's right. And that's right. That's a very...
Because so often you're reading or you're hearing, especially if somebody gets given like a speech, and then later on, you know, they always have to say what that person said. And this gives a couple of words there, and that is the quote that person said.
All right.
And
all right.
If you tune in, turn it in then, well, you've got the whole thing wrong with that person, how that person is doing. Because it turns.
All right, that's a comment about how other people, letting other people interpret what it is that someone says or is doing rather than making your own judgment about it. That's a very common thing we do, isn't it? And I hear around here, and I've heard around here now for about a week, that's something the media often do, is try to interpret and lead us. I think it's basically something that we all do in many ways. You know, in your own parish, in your own congregation back home, you hire someone to help you interpret the world and so on, don't you? That's one of the roles of the parish pastor, as I understand it. That doesn't mean you agree with them or her. Sometimes you disagree with that person and the way in which he or she interprets that mission. But again, it's a looking. It says something about our attitude toward leadership, toward the people we have chosen, we've made that investment in, and letting them go ahead and judging, and perhaps not judging them too soon. Yes?
I would argue that we need to reform for perspective, that it's very important that we not put the burden of choice on the leader, because if this person stands at the rug, the choice is his, and he doesn't... There is no one but him there in the face of that unprecious little information or knowledge of what's ahead. And I think using that as a perspective, the burden is on us
to
make the choice based on what we do know. I mean, the leadership is good too when we do vote, and that's our political action. But there's more to it than that. We can't be content with that.
Okay, that's a very important perspective on this. The fact that we also recognize, don't we, if we understand what this seems to imply, that the person we may choose to be a leader is always, to some extent, in the dark as well. And his risks, of course, have a major effect on us. The other day when we were talking about the civil rights movement, this issue came up. The question of suppose that Martin Luther King, in accepting the leadership at a certain point for certain aspects of the civil rights movement, and leading the people into the streets, as he did, and as they went, suppose that all of that had failed. Suppose they hadn't been able to be successful. Suppose there had been, well, let me just ask you, if the American Civil Rights Movement had not made it, if you'd not been able to get the laws changed, well, in making it, what happened, you see, in a couple of places was that federal authority replaced state and local authority. Court decisions were made. What if they'd turned wrong? What if that had turned wrong? Think of that responsibility. You cannot put all of that on the leader. Everyone who goes into the streets has to take some responsibility for what happens. On the other hand, the leader has a responsibility of making sure they understand what occurs. Okay, we're getting pretty far, in fact, some would say pretty far afield with this little poem, but you can see where it leads if you get a chance to think about it. What does all this say about the disarmament issue? Anybody prepared to make that leap of faith?
Oh, not necessarily on disarmament, but to me, when I read the poem, you know, these forks in the road are coming all the time, daily, weekly, wherever, for all of us. And then, whereas we might take the left one one day, and we can take the right one tomorrow. And therefore, we should be open to new information and so forth, too. And like particularly with disarmament, because I think as we go through this discussion, such as disarmament, why I think many of us are going to, there's so much new, I would say new information, new things to discuss. It's a lot of, for that to be effective, a lot has to change.
All right, there's a dynamic in the living that we do that says we are going to have to make choices. You know, it's just built in, as you say, from day to day. And this is no different than the other kinds of, well, it's substantially very different. Somebody, you know, the choice of creating the atom bomb was clearly more than just a little departure from the norm, but maybe not in the minds of those who did it. And the implications of that are beginning to be felt in major ways, yes. It may be a choice we can't avoid, and understanding that the nature of choice a little bit can be very helpful there, yes.
This poem again, or else it contains, I think, another perhaps more subtle, maybe embedded warning against self-deception and waffling. The speaker of the poem seems to want to happen both ways at times. He says in the last stanza, I should be telling this with a sigh somewhere.
Yes, how about that sigh there?
Is that a regret? And yet he concludes just a few lines later, saying that the road I'm taking has made all the difference. And yet, on what grounds does he know how much difference that has made? If it has made all the difference, then why should he sigh? Is he regretting the road I'm taking? So there's some, perhaps, in that there is a partial.
All the way through the poem and the person. Yeah, go ahead.
Perhaps self-satisfied or both right. Ways again, not going far enough to know what the real difference
right.
Is.
See, all this is all the way through the poem. Yeah, that's not that much different choice. You know, it would have made a lot of difference which one I did, but in the end, it makes all the difference, he says. He or she says, the persona, yes.
There's one thing he's not saying. Is I wish I could make it better. And some people will be known that if only I could have done it.
Right.
So it's my life would be a different day.
All right, he doesn't. The person doesn't say, I wish I had taken the other road. But he sighs. You know, there's a certain ambivalence there. Okay. Any other observations about this poem?
I think the point, if I can elaborate on the questions that regarding disarmament, is the point is we cannot continue waffling, continue saying what should we do, how will we do it, which road might we take, but that we need to start making a decision, make a decision, get there in the road.
And at some point that means looking at the forks and seeing what they are. You know, coming to that point where there's a choice.
Our churches, our governments, you know, there's a lot of people that have to make things.
Yes, it's no mean thing to make a choice. We've already seen that. I mean, if you've been listening to these the sessions, I hope you sense how much people are struggling with this stuff, with this whole issue. It's not a very comfortable situation.
I wonder, when it begins with two roads diverged in a yellow wood, I think, in some ways, what do we make of that? If there are the two roads and the yellow wood is rather pleasant, but it doesn't indicate really, you know, one bend in the undergrowth, but we really don't have any hint of where they're going, but it doesn't seem as if they're going to an unpleasant place either one.
We don't know. A good point, though. Boom. But it's important not to carry something like this too far, I think. Really important not to do it. One of the things, in reaction to that, one of the things I immediately think of because of the kind of training I have, because of what's been happening to me over the last week here at Holden, is one thing I really know is that when you get out in the woods, it's very hard to see. It's very hard to see where you're going. Whether they're yellow or whether they're otherwise, but that's really important. This is not necessarily a choice between a good route and a bad route. Not necessarily a choice between a right alternative and not a right alternative, and so on. Though it can be, it is not necessarily. All right. Anything else on this?
Well, don't you feel though that they're connecting with the song that? And the disarmament, it brings another aspect to people, but bringing that up, there's lots of them that brought them closer to the Lord. Because, I mean, it's the disarmament that they're bringing out, but yet they're thinking individually of themselves. Am I living the life? Bringing more people to help others learn about their faith, and more people helping those that can't go to church with their support. So, what is it going to be the end of time? Which is through year after year, every generation thinks it's going to be from the very beginning.
That's really an interesting perspective. It makes me think of the possibility that one of the things that's significant about choice, as it's described here, and as we think about it, is the test of the individual it provides, and the way in which it makes one sensitive to all the things that are implied by that choice, and the relationship one has with his sense of direction and conscience and faith and whatever that sort of thing is. All right. Good. Well, we've already belabored the poem far past the point that I thought we would, but I hope that it gives you a sense of the way in which something very simple like this, that is basically metaphorical, can open up our sensitivity and our thinking. I want to say just three quick things about this poem. One is that the whole road in the wood thing is obviously what we call a metaphor. To use again, so that we get some consistency, we might define metaphor in a number of ways, but I like Christine Carlson's saying, as she did the other day, that it's a finger pointing toward the moon, that out of the specific, we get up into the unknown and the unthought about and the cosmic, in a sense.
Can you repeat that?
It's a finger pointing toward the moon. That if you take something you can get hold of, specific like this, that it leads off into a way of dealing with an unknown and a more cosmic kind of a generalization. From the specific to the general in the broad.
It's not like the rock is God, it's the rock points to God.
All right. That's what she said. The rock is not God, but the rock points to God, was her way of putting that. The second is that over in the bookstore, for those of you who love The Road Not Taken, I notice that there is a little card you can get that's got that poem on it, if that is inexpensive. And I happen to think it's a neat poem, and I'm glad to see that there. The third thing is that the other thing they've got over there, which is maybe the best bargain in the Holden bookstore, is a paperback edition, a big, thick paperback edition of all of Robert Frost's poetry. And for those of you who are interested in this and who like this kind of language and poetry, I think you'll find it really worth getting. Maybe everybody knows all they want to about Robert Frost, but I've never found that to be the case. Okay, thank you.
So you might want to look at that too.
I always like to promote not only good literature, but things that they have at the Holden Bookstore. I'm going to use another foreign document, the first few paragraphs of a marvelous book called How Green Was My Valley by Richard Llewellyn, to illustrate how the opening of a novel can do some of the things that The Road Not Taken will do. I'm going to skip over that and get down to the same part of 1984. But let me just mention that How Green Was My Valley is a story about a poor boy who is given opportunity and makes the most of it, and it's Welsh. It's a Welsh author, and it's sort of a Welsh coal mining family. Someone who goes on to move out of that environment through education. It's always been one of my favorite stories of opportunity. But let us move to another kind of opportunity, the kind of opportunity that Winston faces. Winston Smith faces as we look at the beginning of 1984. How many of you have read or are reading 1984 at some point? All right. The opening of any piece of literature, and particularly of novels, is a very important point. I mean, for one thing, you know, if the author doesn't get to us then, we're probably not going to read any further. So there's that kind of thing. But second, we need to remember that everything that a creative person puts into a work is, in some sense, a very deliberate and thoughtful choice, and it's intended to lead us in a direction. It's intended to open things up to us in, I would argue, somewhat the same way that Robert Frost tries to do in the poem, The Road Not Taken. And so I want to read two paragraphs at the beginning of 1984 as an example of how, when you look at a piece like this, if you let yourself into it, first of all, if you just sort of let yourself get into the feeling of the thing, and then second, if you watch for what are some of the same kinds of clues that you find in The Road Not Taken, the same sorts of pointing from the specific to the big picture that will help you begin to see very early what it is that we're up to as far as talking about perspective on the world we find ourselves in, which we find ourselves. This book starts out, "It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Winston Smith, his chin nuzzled into his breast in an effort to escape the vile wind, slipped quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with him." What do we already know? just listening to them. He slipped quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering with him. All right, it's already, we don't get a sense that this is a yellow wood, do we? All right, there's certain furtive, you know, just stuff. Good, all right, that's enough for that. Then he's inside. The hallway smelt of boiled cabbage and old rag mats. At one end of it, a colored poster, too large for indoor display, had been tacked to the wall. It depicted simply an enormous face, more than a meter wide. The face of a man of about 45 with a heavy black mustache and ruggedly handsome features. Winston made for the stairs. It was no use trying the lift. Uh-oh. Even at the best of times, it was seldom working, and at present, the electric current was cut off during daylight hours. It was part of the economy drive in preparation for heat week. So that's something like Christmas at Holden, heat week. The flat was 7 flights up, and Winston, who was 39 and had a varicose ulcer above his right ankle, went slowly, resting several times on the way. On each landing opposite the lift shaft, the poster with the enormous face gazed from the wall. It was one of those pictures which are so contrived that the eyes follow you about when you move. "Big Brother is watching you," the caption beneath it ran. Now, that's the two paragraphs. Now we're all sensitized to the road not taken and the language of it. What do you know? What do you know where you are already two paragraphs into this now? That's a real jump. Winston Smith has precious little choice, she said. What do you mean by that? How can you tell that?
Well, you get an immediate sense of there's some greater command than he lifts us for the electricity is off. He's slipping furtively up the stairs, and there are eyes that watch him. You don't have any sense of individuality
here. Right. Okay.
The situation is fraught with pain.
Right, there's pain here. Winston is not well, 39 years old. We're going to see more of that a little later on, and I think maybe in the next page we find out he's got a chronic cough. The environment in which he lives is not particularly healthy. And we get a sense of, right away in these first two paragraphs, we also get a sense of the theme of the novel. Big Brother is watching it. Now, I have to admit that we get more of a sense of that today, 35 years after this book was published, than we might have reading it the first time, because this is the book that made Big Brother a household word. Nevertheless, the eyes watching and all of that. That's enough of that. That goes on and all the way through the book. Any book, any piece of creative work, and almost anything that is intended to be in some ways metaphorical, you're going to find those things. And without belaboring it, that's the kind of watchfulness that will help you to get into the significance of a book like this. Now, there are other ways to do that too, and I particularly, if you want to get this sort of cheating, but if you want to get an idea of the perspective of this book on the arms race, besides reading it, or in addition to reading it, I hope not instead of, there's an essay at the back written by Eric Fromm, which was not written in 1980, in preparation for Holden Village's Summer on Living the Politics of Hope. But it was written in 1961, and it was an attempt to update this book. This book was written after the atom bomb exploded, the first one, but before thermonuclear weapons, as we know them, developed. And in 1961, in a magazine, Eric Fromm wrote of the history of the Christian ethic and what thermonuclear war means, and what, with that in mind, 1984 speaks to in terms of those things. This is an impressive book. I already mentioned, again, I'm trying to get, I hope some of you might be interested in rethinking and thinking about this book again, and perhaps even in rereading it, either in the library or through the bookstore or parts of it. This is a novel that is much talked about as a book about war and armaments, and as a negative utopia. And in the last, yesterday, we were sort of exploring up on the lawn, some of us, the fact that there is a love story in this novel about a relationship between Winston Smith and Julia, which the government in this novel has to deliberately set out to destroy. And the question of why they have to do that, why the government has to do that, is one of the keys to unwinding us. And folks, it's all going to be revealed on Saturday in the discussion we have here or Koinonia, I'm not sure which place, on Love and Hope in 1984 and beyond. But, yes? What?
How does the obstructor keep? What does that have to do?
Why does it say that? That's a double. Right. Okay. That's a good question. That's a double. There's double significance to that. Why did it say the clock struck 13? What does it suggest to you?
It's too late to make your decision.
All right. That may be influenced somewhat by the discussion we just had. But that's the sort of thing. Okay. What? Somebody else? All right, 13 is a little weird. 13 is a little weird, isn't it? It suggests bad luck. It's got a lot of connotations that are here. But there's a way in which this is an example of real order. It is England, so it's in Europe. I mean, well, it's London, I should say. It isn't England as we know it. But 24-hour clock in Europe. To some of us, it also suggests military time. Who knows? But I think it isn't, there's a reason it isn't 10. And the reason it isn't 15. And the reason it doesn't say six bells and so on. It says 13. And that's really a good question. To which I don't have a definitive answer. But it helps to create the atmosphere that this is something that's a little unusual. I frankly don't know what it would do for an English person who lives in England now. I don't know that much about the.
For us, it's sort of, you know, I'd like to read on.
Good. All right. Now I'd like to jump to another piece. We have 5 minutes. And this is a chapter, a very short one, from the Martian Chronicles. We're not going to discuss this. I'm just going to read this to you, or as much of it as I can get read by 5 o'clock. And I start out by asking the question, what I would like you to think about, especially if you're going to come back Saturday, but in any case, is why. We're not going to be able to do all even of this short chapter, but this is a Martian Chronicles is a novel by Ray Bradbury written about the same time as 1984. And it's a sort of loose collection of episodes about the settling of Mars, people from the Earth who fled to Mars for various sorts of reasons. And this chapter is entitled The Watchers, and on one night they have word that the Earth is going to blow up, these people who have left it it's called atomic war here. And it says, to all intents and purposes, Earth was now dead. They had been away from it 3 or 4 years. Space was an anesthetic. 70 million miles of space numbed you, put memory to sleep, depopulated Earth, erased the past, and allowed these people here to go on with their work. But now tonight the dead were risen, Earth was re-inhabited, memory awoke, a million names were spoken. What was so-and-so doing tonight on Earth? What about this one and that one? The people on the porches glanced sidewise at each other's faces. At 9 o'clock, Earth seemed to explode, catch fire, and burn. The people on the porches put up their hands as if to beat the fire out. They waited. By midnight, the fire was extinguished. Earth was still there. There was a sigh like an autumn wind from the porches. We haven't heard from Harry for a long time. He's all right. We should send a message to Mother. She's all right. Is she? No, don't worry. Will she be all right, do you think? Of course, of course. Now come to bed. But nobody moved. Late dinners were carried out onto the night lawns and set upon collapsible tables, and they picked at these slowly until 2 o'clock, and the light radio message, Morse code, flashed through the sky so they could see it, until that flash from Earth. They could read, Australian continent atomized in premature explosion of atomic stockpile, Los Angeles, London bombed, war, come home. Come home, come home. They stood up from their tables. Come home, come home, come home. Have you heard from your brother Ted this year? You know, with mail rates, $5 a letter to Earth, I don't write much. Come home. I've been wondering about Jane. You remember Jane, my kid sister? Come home. At 3 in the chilly morning, the luggage store proprietor glanced up. A lot of people were coming down the street. Stayed open late on purpose. What'll it be, mister? By dawn, the luggage was gone from his shelves. Here's a large number of people flee to Mars to avoid atomic war. The war hits. They set up new lives on Mars. And what did they do? They turned around and went home. Does that surprise you? Does that surprise you? Is that a big shock? Is it something you would do? All right, here is clearly an episode in this book, very short one, with great significance for the total, for total perspective on the nature of human beings and the kinds of relationships they have with each other and the way in which they respond to crises. And it is the sort of thing that we really need to puzzle about and think about as we try to relate literature to the issues of our lives. And I'll just let you do that. I'm going to tell you that if you buy this book, there aren't many copies over there, but if they buy it, if you buy it, you're going to have a very interesting experience. You may not get the exact answer to that question. It is something that you're going to have to. You will have to work out for yourself. Again, all will be revealed on Saturday. No, that's really a terrible thing to say, because the reason that I would like to have you read with some sense of the art and of the significance of one thing for another and the interrelationships among things and the questions that are asked in literature is so that you can have that wonderful experience yourself of being, of just having those worlds opened up, as I think only literature can do for you. Thank you.